Now we get on to the Olivet Discourse, which is a much argued about part of the scriptures. We can't get into all of the ins and outs of it here. I'm just going to try to give a straightforward exposition as I see it. What we find in verse 1 is a seg between chapter 23, particularly the end of it, and the prophetic tone of chapters 24 and 25. Then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. The Jerusalem temple was not one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, but it was one of the most famous buildings of the ancient world, and was certainly prized as being a magnificent structure, and so was very famous throughout the Roman world. There's no wonder, therefore, that they were talking to him about it. And Jesus said to them, "Do you not see all these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down." This response is fairly typical when it comes to what man has built. We see Paul in Acts 17 in Athens, not at all being overawed by speaking on the Areopagus with the Parthenon right behind him. These things don't seem to bother him at all. He has a world view that looks past these inventions of man, even though they've been created with the skills given to man by God, and into that which God has both created around us and those marvels, but also, of course, into the wonders we will behold in the next world that will put to shame anything that we see in this present world. And so Jesus here is really pretty uninterested in the architecture of the temple and just predicts that it's all going to be thrown down. This, of course, has got to do with the Roman destruction of the temple in AD 70. Now, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will these things be?" That is, when will the temple be destroyed? "And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" So we have at least two different questions here, and perhaps three, although the second and third are really one question, since Christ's coming augurs the end of the age. Now, there is obviously a time gap between the destruction of the temple and the coming of Christ and the end of the age. Now, our preterist friends like to say that the coming of Christ and the end of the age are AD 70, but this is not language that befits the Roman general Titus destroying the temple and the Roman soldiers burning it and crucifying and slaughtering the citizens. As we will see, Matthew, in his account, focuses not on the first question of the destruction of the temple, but on the second question about the sign of his coming and the end of the age. Let's notice that there are some verbal cues here which are very easy to spot if we're looking for them. Verse 4, Jesus answered and said to them, "Take heed that no one deceives you." Now, what you're going to find here is you're going to find language similar to what we've encountered in Matthew chapter 10, where the "you" goes beyond the actual disciples and is a proleptic and prophetic "you." "For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will deceive many." Notice that coming in his name is to say that you are him. So the name of Jesus and the identification of Christ in his second coming, because that's the context here, are one and the same. Now, it's important that we understand the implications of verse 5. Verse 5 takes us beyond AD 70, because this is an individual who is claiming to be Christ and who is going to deceive many people. Now, some people could say, is this Simon ben Kosiba, Simon bar Kokhba, who claimed to be the Messiah under the auspices of Rabbi Akiva in 132 AD, and of course who was crushed by Rome under Hadrian 3 years later? No, I don't think that's it at all, because of the context that we see. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. Notice that word, the end. So what is Jesus talking about? He's answering the question about the end of the age that was asked in verse 3. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. He's kind of mapping out quite a long history here, isn't he? And there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Now, I do not believe there are any signs for the church. I believe the signs are signs that have to do with the second coming of Christ and are mainly for Israel and those in the tribulation. But it is possible that we experience some of the beginning of sorrows. I don't think we can call them signs, but I think there are things that may point to the end times. I certainly do not believe in newspaper exegesis, and I don't believe that we should speculate on whether this disaster or that happening or this political maneuver is a sign of the end times. We just don't have the perspective to do that. Just simply to say that we might experience some of the beginning of sorrows, not that we will. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And so this seems to be looking past the immediate disciples. And then many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. This is similar to what was said in chapter 10. Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. Now this starts to take us into Daniel territory and has some of those overtones, if you're familiar with chapters 7 through 9 of that book. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. Now what's the end? The end, I believe, in the context, is the end of the age. And this gospel of the gospel of the kingdom is what? It's the gospel that John the Baptist preached in chapter 3 and the gospel that Jesus preached. It's the gospel of the fact that the kingdom is being announced. And the one in the person of the Messiah who is going to bring it in is here. Now that would certainly fit a second coming and second advent preaching. That would make the gospel of the kingdom not the gospel that is preached today. And I think, you know, we need to be careful of this word gospel. It just means good news. And just because it's used in Paul and elsewhere to speak of the gospel of the grace of God and justification by faith doesn't mean it's used in every instance like that. And it doesn't seem to be used in that sense here. It's the gospel of the kingdom, and it's the coming kingdom, the eschatological kingdom that's in mind here. This gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then will the end come, the end of the age. Now, what characterizes the end? It doesn't look very good, but then we're going to get some more information here. Verse 15. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, and then Matthew adds, whoever reads, let him understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, etc. Now what's the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel? Notice Jesus calls him a prophet here. That's why he's put in the prophets in the Protestant Bible. But what is this abomination of desolation? Well, the first thing we can say about it is that it stands in the holy place. Therefore, it appears to be some kind of an image, some kind of a statue or something. And it's put in the holy place. The holy place is the naos, it's the holy of holies in the temple. Now, the temple was destroyed in AD 70. So either he's talking about an abomination that was set up before AD 70 and put in the Holy of Holies, or he's talking about an abomination at the end of the age, that will be placed in the holy place. Now, if that's the case, then we need to have a holy place to put the image in, and therefore we need a rebuilt temple. Now, there are three places in Daniel that we need to look for the abomination of desolation. Daniel 9:27, Daniel 11:31, and Daniel 12, verse 11. So let's have a look at those texts. In Daniel 9:27, we have an individual confirming a covenant with Israel, because that's the context, verse 24, and he confirms it for 1 week, which we take to be 7 years. See our course on Daniel for that, and also our study on eschatology in the Doctrine of the Last Things and our systematic theology. But in the middle of the week, that would be 3.5 years, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. Now, what do you need in order to have a place of sacrifice and offering? Well, you need an altar, and in a Jewish context, you need a temple. And so if Daniel's 70th week, which is what this is about, speaks of the future, and I believe it does, then again it requires a rebuilt temple. And on the wing of abominations shall be one who makes desolate. Now, admittedly, this is a difficult text, but the New King James does translate it correctly as abominations, not abomination, in verse 27. And so the wing of abominations probably has to do with an overspreading of different abominations, particularly idolatrous ones, at some point. And I would say the point is somewhere in the tribulation. And there's an ordained time for this, as referred to in the last clause, even until the consummation, which is determined, is poured out on the desolate. So there's a definite limiting of the desolations here. So Daniel 9:27 may have something to do with what Jesus is referring to, but it's far more likely that he's speaking of the abomination, singular, of desolation. And for that, we need to look at the other two references in Daniel. First of all, in Daniel 11 and verse 31, "And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation." Now you see, that fits the context much better. Here we have an abomination which is an idol. It's something that replaces the normal duties and stands in its place. So it stands for idolatry of the temple, the sanctuary, in verse 31. Now, there's only one problem with this identification, and that is that most commentators, and I think they are quite correct, identify this abomination with the one that was set up by Antiochus Epiphanes in the 2nd century BC. So an abomination of desolation and the stopping of the sacrifices does fit the temple context, but Jesus, of course, is speaking of something that's going to happen in the future. And so do we have a reference to an abomination of desolation in the future? Yes, we do. It's in Daniel 12. In Daniel 12:11, we read, "And from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away and the abomination of desolation is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Now, what is the context of Daniel 12:11? We still see a daily sacrifice, so it's a temple atmosphere that's being spoken of. The abomination of desolation is being set up. Therefore, it is not a person, it is a thing, and it has to do with idolatry. But look at the context, verse 9. "He said," this is the angel speaking to him, "Go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end." Do you see that? That's what Jesus is talking about. That fits the context, because Jesus is speaking about the time of the end. And so this abomination of desolation in this holy place, in Daniel 12:11, fits the abomination of desolation that we find in the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24:15. That is the one that Jesus is speaking about in this context. Now, the 1,290 days in Daniel's prophecy, I believe, include the 1,260 days, or approximately 3.5 years, of the latter part of the tribulation, which are measured from the time of the setting up of the abomination of desolation. And they last until 30 days after the second coming of Christ, during which, perhaps, and we can only speculate, Jesus is setting up his kingdom and is judging the earth. But anyway, this is not a commentary on Daniel, so let's get back to Matthew 24. And let's see if this fits. Verse 16, when they see it, then let those who are in Judea, notice the Jewish setting, flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house. They have to flee quickly, speedily. Let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. This kind of urgency reminds us of what we read in Revelation chapter 12, when Satan, in the guise of the dragon, is chasing after the woman, who, in the context, is most definitely Israel, not the church, and pursues her for 1,260 days, or 42 months, or 3.5 years, or a time times and half a time. And so, as Revelation was written, despite what the preterists try to say, around about AD 95 or 96, that is 20-odd years after the destruction of the temple, then again, can you see this pushes the Olivet Discourse beyond the armies of Vespasian and puts it into the end times, which is, of course, what the context tells us, verses 13 and 14. Now let's get more of the picture. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days, and pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath. So again, Sabbath observance, we're not talking about Western Europe here or America. We're talking about Israel. For then, at this time, whenever it is, verse 21, there will be great tribulation, such as not been since the beginning of the world, until this time, no, nor ever shall be. So this is a particular time of persecution and tribulation that outranks every other time of tribulation in the world's history. It's going to be so bad. It's going to be so intense. And it's only going to last a limited amount of time. Verse 22, unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. And I believe they will be shortened to a period of 1,260 days, or the second half of the tribulation. The elect in verse 22 is Israel. It's not the church. Every time you see the word elect, it doesn't mean the church, particularly in a context like this, and to the people he's talking to. The disciples wouldn't have thought church when they heard the word elect. They would have thought Israel, in line with Isaiah 65 and other places. 4. Going back to the idea of false Christs and false prophets that have already been brought up. False Christs, false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. And so the deceptions that Jesus spoke about in verse 5 and verse 11 are not just merely the deceptions of people who speak well. These are deceptions of people that show miraculous signs and wonders, which is certainly what signs and wonders means in verse 24. This is why even the elect of Israel would be deceived, if possible. This is talking about, by the way, just interject here, the remnant of Israel, the true Israel. Not everyone who is a Jew is of the true Israel. The true Israel are all Jews, but not all Jews are the true Israel. See, I have told you beforehand. Therefore, if they say to you, look, he is in the desert, do not go out. Or look, he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. This is what will be happening. People will be saying, here's Messiah, he's over here, he's over there. But don't believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. Now, I live in Texas, and we have some pretty good lightning storms here, and when the lightning flashes from the east to the west, you can't miss it. That's what Jesus is saying. He's not saying that it will be lightning, but it will be like lightning. Everybody will observe it. Everybody will see it. And this backs up the context of the end of the age and the other part of the question that they're asked in verse 3, your coming. In fact, the sign of your coming. Notice that, because Jesus is going to talk about that particularly in verse 30. And then he says, rather cryptically, in verse 28, for wherever the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together. What does that mean? Well, just obviously, eagles are birds of prey, and so if there's a carcass there, the eagles will be picking at it. It's not saying that the carcass was there and the eagles came, like buzzards. Eagles will kill it and then start to eat it. So where you see a carcass, you see eagles. What's the point? The obvious thing is to put the two together. Where there's one, there'll be the other. When you see these things, expect the end of the age, expect the coming of the Son of Man. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, this is Old Testament imagery, and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And so we'll either believe Stephen Hawking and the astronomers and say that's impossible, and that just won't happen, and this is all figurative, or we'll believe what the Bible says and say, well, God, who put them up there in the first place in double quick time, is very capable of producing these effects. Now, whether these will actually happen or whether it will appear to be this way from the human vantage point, I will leave up to those who experience it. But either way, we need to believe what verse 29 says. Then, verse 30, the sign of the Son of Man. Who's the Son of Man? Jesus. Jesus is in Jerusalem to endure the cross. He's told them that in chapter 20, verses 18 and 19, remember. Then the sign, that's what they've asked for, of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. Then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, for they will see the Son of Man, just as everyone who is in a lightning storm sees the lightning flash from the east to the west. You can't avoid seeing it. They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Now, where on earth did he get that from? Daniel chapter 7, the original Son of Man chapter. Daniel chapter 7, verse 13. I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. So Jesus at his second coming fulfills that Son of Man prophecy. Now there were people at the time of his first advent who were expecting him to fulfill that prophecy, but he didn't. He will do at his second coming. And of course, the transfiguration in Matthew 17 is an adumbration of that. And then he speaks about sending his angels, like he already did do in some of the parables of the kingdom in chapter 13. He will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. And then he tells another parable. Who can read this and not believe that he's talking about the future, even from our standpoint? He's not talking about the Romans destroying the temple. That wasn't as a sign as lightning flashing from east to west. That wasn't all the tribes of the earth mourning when they saw the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven in power and great glory. Relating verses 27 and 30 to the Roman armies in AD 70 is about the worst exegesis of a biblical passage that can possibly occur. The two things are not the same by any stretch of the imagination, unless one has just given up totally on the meaning of words. And so he tells this parable, verse 32. Learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So you also, when you see all these things, know that it is near at the doors. The you here is not the disciples. He's speaking to them surely, but he's looking right ahead through church history to the time of the second advent. And he's speaking here about the you of the end times. When you see these things, know that it's near. Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. This is where the preterists camp. They want to take this super literally and say that this generation is the generation that Jesus was speaking to. But it's not in the context. It's the generation that experiences these things. In other words, the generation that is living at the time of the end. It's the generation that will say, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." Chapter 23, verse 39. Another second coming passage. Heaven and earth will pass away. That's going to happen. But my words will by no means pass away. Now, I don't believe that the heaven and earth passing away happens at the second coming of Christ. Some people do on the basis of texts like this. But this is just saying that the present state of things will not continue forever. Things are going to change and change radically. But the words of the Lord do not pass away because they reflect his character. But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. Do you think the angels of heaven knew about AD 70? I think so. I can't prove it, but it's very doubtful that they didn't. But as the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. All right, let's see what he says about the days of Noah. That involved a worldwide flood, didn't it? For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and did not know until the flood came and took them all away, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. How can that be AD 70? You think the people didn't see the Roman armies marching up to the temple in AD 67? This has got to do with the end times. Then, verse 40, two men will be in the field. One will be taken and the other left. That's interesting. Taken by who? Possibly, in the context, by the angels of verse 31. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken and the other left. Some people have tried to say this is taken to judgment on the basis of the fact that the angels gather the bundles together to burn them before they gather the elect in the parables, especially the parable of the wheat and the tares. That may be so, but whichever way it is, it's certainly an end times happening. Watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. It would seem strange, since the Lord is coming back in flaming fire, taking vengeance on those that don't know God, according to 2 Thessalonians 1, that those that are left are blessed. It would seem that it is better to be taken than left in this context. But I'm happy to leave that question open and see what happens in the future. Watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Now, of course, we don't know that a thief's going to break in. If we did, we'd be watching. This is the idea. Expect the Lord to come back. Expect that your house is going to be robbed. Expect that things are going to be turned upside down. And keep watching. This certainly goes beyond the disciples. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. Who then is a faithful and wise servant, whom his master made ruler over his household, to give them food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. So here's a servant who is given a duty to apportion food, and the master comes back unexpectedly, but he finds the servant doing exactly what he's been tasked to do. He's been faithful. Assuredly, I say to you that he will make him ruler over all his goods. God values faithfulness. But if that evil servant says in his heart, my master is delaying his coming, and begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with drunkards, thinking that he's got time to spare, the master of that servant will come on a day when he is not looking for him, and at an hour that he is not aware of, and will cut him in two, and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. What does it mean to cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites? Well, the hypocrites, we know in chapter 23, are children of hell. And so that's what the portion is. And this figure of slicing or cutting in two is probably meant figuratively, but its severity is meant to alarm. The servant who is unfaithful and who is wicked will be condemned, will be judged when the Lord comes back. Now, for many people, that's the end of the Olivet Discourse, but of course it does continue into the next chapter.